Okay. Good morning. So, I should start with an introduction today. It's very short. If you believe that you know what this means, I shall try to show you that you don't know. I'm sure. And then I shall speak about monotheism, what's called monotheism, or the Jewish contribution to monotheism. Not too great, as you imagine. But I would like to start with a very short introduction, which will show that we are living in a world full of cliché, a lot of cliché, by Jews and by others about this. What I'm going to do is to offer you my cliché, and you'll judge better or worse. So let me try to summarize the beginning, the Bible, which is the earliest, most important book in today's, but I should do it very, very short, because I assume that you know that it's the Bible, and what it was written, etc., but the content I would like to summarize, nevertheless. The Bible can be reduced to one word. This word is what? Read the Bible, you would see. We have two major issues. What happened in history, from the beginning of creation up to a certain moment? And the other most important topic is what to do, really. So just one word. You don't have anything else. You don't have a philosophy. You don't have a description of God. On this we are going to speak much more. But the entire Bible is actually dealing with a story in which there are commandments. The story is presented as a history of the world and the history of humankind and then the history of the Jewish people. Telling us what happened. So it's in the Bible. What you don't find in the Bible. You don't find a lot of very important issues. Right? Discussions of who is God. Which we're going to discuss in a moment, much more. That's not an issue. You don't find anything about why do the commandments? What is the logic of the commandments? You don't have a philosophy of the ritual. You don't have a mythology. You have apodictic discussions telling you what to do. So, I finish. The first millennium before the coming era. First, 2 days in the first millennium. Dealing with one single question, and that is what? Now I'm moving to a second millennium, meaning the first millennium of the coming era, which is after the Bible was canonized, and then we have another major book, which is the Talmud. Let me attempt to summarize the Talmud in one word. I believe I can do it, and this one word is how. Meaning, the Bible is very brief, succinct. You really don't know a lot. That's the style of the Bible. And that was recognized by people like Auerbach, comparing the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, basically. The Hebrew Bible with Homerus, telling you how Homerus giving you a lot of details. The Bible, you don't know. It's a lot of elliptic style. So because of the elliptic style, no one can, in fact, understand the history, which is elliptic. But even more important, understand how to perform the commandments. Because it's too succinct. You have just some few words at the commandment. So what we have in the second millennium of Judaism, which is the first millennium of the common era, you have a long effort to describe how the commandments should be performed. And that is the Talmud. That is also what is called the Midrashic literature, dealing with a part of these commandments and a part with the stories of the Bible, which being elliptic you must fill in. For example, to understand what did Abraham tell Isaac on the way. They were, you know, working together. They assumed that they spoke something. The Bible doesn't enter into these psychologies. So it was left for imagination. The Midrash, which is the other part of rabbinic literature, in addition to the Talmud, filled in. What did they speak about? Which is also full of imagination. The Midrash is an imagination of all the elite in the Bible. So I summarize now the second millennium of Judaism. Now, to finish my introduction to this, I speak about the third millennium, which is the millennium we just finished, in which can be summarized fairly, I believe, by again one word, and that is light. So the Jews at the moment started to ask, And then a huge literature emerged that I know to speak much more about it, attempting to describe why, after all, we do what is written in the Bible and how we're doing it. So I finish my introduction to today's three minutes. So that is today's an attempt to tell you what God would like us to know about the world and how to do it, and later on why do it, etc. What's going to be our millennium? We speak in the millennium, and I should try to find one word to summarize what happens in this millennium, but that's too early for example. So I hope that you understood the thing, and I don't ask you questions. I gave you three questions, and that's my introduction to this. Now, let's return to the Bible now for a moment. What is basic for the Bible? Basic for the Talmud, and in my opinion, basic also for the medieval today's, is the strong incoherence. Not incoherence, because anything, you know, all the basic alphas are incoherent. You can't, it doesn't matter whom. That incoherence is human, in my opinion, a human condition. I'm speaking about Judaism, about strong incoherence, which means in the Bible, by having a variety of authors, what's called the theory of the documents of the Bible, there are different documents put together by who knows whom. So, it's not just a small, how to put it, issues that we correspond. We're speaking about different authors in different centuries, speaking in different directions, put together. That's why I think about strong incoherence. That's why the Bible, and that's, from my point of view, very, very, very important, the Bible is not a book of theology. That the most important mistake making this religion, that the Bible was conceived to be a theological book. And people wrote who knows how many hundreds of books on the theology of the Bible. There's no theology in the Bible. There are at least many theologies, if there's a theology, if there are theologies at all. But if there are theologies at all, there are many. So only recently, let's say in the last 110 years, people enter this idea of theory of documents in the Bible. It's different documents, different divinities, and different theological worldviews. And that's why, in my opinion, it is a futile attempt to find the theology of the Bible. But what I would like to emphasize is the fact that there is a strong incoherence, and you will see why the term strong is very, very important. I mean, it's not a matter of mistakes, like a philosopher. Even philosophers are unable to give you a coherence. But that's, how to put it, that is a matter of the weakness of a certain human mind, doesn't matter if it's called Spinoza or Kant. It's impossible to create out of language a coherent system. Reality, whatever it is more complex. Even if you're going to read great minds like Einstein, you see that he is admitting that's impossible. And he attempted to unify everything, but he was unable. So that's a condition, a human condition. It's not something specific to the Bible. But in the Bible, there's no effort to bring together all those qualities. That's why I think about strong. But what is more important than the strong incoherence is the fact that the Bible is the production of a collective effort. And that's very, very important. Not one author was unable to bring together, one editor, to bring together different documents, but it is a collective issue, and that's why it is strong obvious. Because collective enterprises are very, very important, but they never achieve a degree of coherence. It's obvious even more in the Talmud, which is not a matter of incoherence here or there. It is based on the assumption on every page of the Talmud that we agree for a while on issue, on a certain issue. But there are other views which are also important. We should remember them. They are minority views, but they may turn sometime in the future into majority. And we should put together all the different issues, that no matter if we agree or don't agree. So from this point of view, the Talmud, which is also a collective enterprise, is replete with different views which are competing all the time, and there is no attempt to offer one final vision. We have something which is called, if you like, democratic decision in favor of one view or another. But that was not done by excluding the other views. So we have again a collective enterprise in which theological coherence is not dreamed because the Talmud doesn't care about who God is. I mean, there's a certain issue, though. We are not to enter in examples, but God and the Talmud is even less important than the Bible. So incoherence is there, but not theological incoherence because it didn't care about it. Now, what we find in the third phase of the last millennium have also a lot of different voices in the same systems. I'm going to speak much more about it. In which the degree of incoherence is still clear even in individual thinkers, like Maimonides and many, many others, who would like to have a coherent, maybe, not so clear, but let's say they attempted to have some form of coherence, they didn't succeed, because they were working as commentators on the Bible and on the Talmud, and that's impossible to be coherent when you comment on such incoherent books. And in the case of Maimonides, for example, we may discuss it. I shall do it also, it's my view, but maybe he's an exception, maybe. So, what I would like to discuss here is not the theology of the lesson, but in fact, the variety of theologies which emerged and completed all the time, including in the same writings, via centuries. So that is what I attempted to do here. Not to dream now all the time the Bible and the Talmud, which is I'm not an expert. I hope I know more about the medieval period. But I should refer all the time also to what happened in the biblical time and the rabbinic period in order to clarify a little bit what is the background of what I'm speaking about. Okay. I believe that until now I was crystal clear, because this was easy. Now we're coming to something which starts to be a little bit more complex. In my opinion, if we can speak about the Jewish mind in the ancient time, it was different than the other major culture which survived, and then the Greek one. All other cultures disappeared in one way or another. The Syrian and the Egyptian one, the Mesopotamian, disappeared. But what survived, and we are still under the spell, including today, is the Greek way of thinking. That was a basically coherent way of thinking. We have different forms of coherence. But nevertheless, coherence was an ideal. Starting from the pre-Socratic, attempting to find one principle, and then going to Plato and to Aristotle, everyone is bringing another solution, but this solution is done in a way in which you can see a great effort toward coherence. So today is in pre-rabbinic time, and in rabbinic time, coexisted together with Greek philosophy. The Greeks have also mythology and literature and art. I cannot enter here all those great achievements of the Greeks, but what is fascinating is, with one exception that I'm going to discuss in a moment, pre-rabbinic Jews and rabbinic Jews refused to enter the form of speculation of the Greeks. Not that they didn't know, that they knew, there's no doubt. Because some Greek philosophers were living in the land of Israel. Living there, in Nablus, in Syria, in Kedera, not far away from Tel Aviv today. They were Greek philosophers. We know the names. So, Jews knew in Greek. They're mentioning here and there of Americans, but it is quite obvious, reading the entire Jewish literature which survived in Hebrew and Aramaic, they didn't want this type of speculation. It was a refusal. That was a cultural decision. Maybe they were unable to think in an abstract way. We will discuss it. Maybe. But I'm sure that it was also a decision. I shall try to explain this decision. When we return to the Bible and we read the Bible, you'll see that the Bible is a book about concrete issues. You don't have abstract terms in the Bible. Ancient Hebrew is a concrete language. It's recognized. Not my invention. More than 100 years ago, a very important scholar named Alan Freinan wrote about it. That's, you know, very, very complicated language. That's true. You don't have abstract terms. That is, I don't know if it's Semitic or Jewish early propensity. You speak about concrete issues because all the other issues, which are abstract, but to call it speculative, but to call it theological, cannot be decided. There are issues of opinion. And what can be decided in a social sphere are the concrete issues. What do you do? When do you do? How do you do? So, the Greek, excuse me, the Hebrew of the Bible, and also the Hebrew of the Talmudic literature, is extremely concrete. Avoiding generalizations, abstractions, to attempt to organize a common form of life, which must be concrete. And if that were rabbis, who had their theologies, and I'm sure there were rabbis having their theology, they're entitled to their theology as long as their private theology. They don't bring this theology to the common discourse. They don't impose a theology on the community or on the society. But I don't say that, but specific rabbis didn't have their theology. That's impossible. But this is not my issue. My issue is, we have books And I try to describe what is found in those books. Because this is the social fact. And not the fact that one rabbi or another has his theology. So, the language of the Bible and of the rabbinic literature is extremely concrete. Ritualistic, communal. You don't find abstract terms. Those abstract terms appeared in Hebrew in the medieval period, translations from Arabic. We're going to discuss it. That is, not because Jews couldn't invent or adopt abstract way of thinking, but they believe that that is mere speculation. So, for example, they could learn, and I believe that they also knew, that Plato is different from Aristotle. So who is right? So if you are entering now in discussions about the nature of God, the nature of the soul, the nature of the of nature, you never end this discussion. That's futile discussions, which may destroy society. I want to emphasize, may destroy society. So for an elite which was interested to create a community, abstract discussions are counterproductive. They're a matter of private curiosity and interest. That's another issue. There was no interdiction to speculate. But as long as you don't bring it to, how to put it, the common discussion, that's fine. Let me assume now some rabbis having a look to the history of Greece. What happened to the history of Greece? In the moment the Greek attained the most abstract way of thinking, Aristotle, Greek society disappeared. Have a look what happened. The student of Aristotle, Alexander the Great, is the last, actually, common denominator of Greek society, and then we have some form of Hellenistic combination. Greek society disappeared in the moment in which the Greeks achieved the most comprehensive system they had. Let's say the rabbi also had some abstract way of thinking and could see this lesson. When you bring to the table issues which are extraordinarily abstract, there is no social basis. They can agree on it, and then, in a way, it is counterproductive. Let's say the rabbis learned this lesson, that we are entering in grand systems, and at a certain moment we are losing the society. We can introduce a big philosophy that will survive, like a big one. But from the social point of view, that's the end. That's why I assume not only the biblical language is concrete, but also the rabbinic one, which is not only based on the biblical concrete language, but also on this lesson that look what happened to a society which became so abstract. So, that is the reason why rabbinic literature, which is full of imagination, is concrete, but it is imaginaire of the concrete. Again, I cannot enter all, demonstrate to you all what I'm saying, but rabbinic literature is dealing a lot with hypothetical issues, a lot. But all those hypotheses have to do with something concrete. If this event will take place in a certain moment, in a certain day, so that is for sure full of imagination. But this imagination has nothing to do with abstractions like Plato, but with concrete issues which can take place in one condition or another, and how do you solve the problem? So that is, in my opinion, the lesson that rabbinic elite learned from the encounter with Greek philosophy. And there is no one single book, with the exception in a moment that I'm going to discuss, it's very important, which in my opinion is not even an exception, but we'll discuss in a moment, why you don't have one single book in Hebrew or Aramaic dealing with nature, with God, with the soul, with mathematics, geometrics, no one single book for 2,000 years of Jewish literary tradition. Meaning this systematic approach, which is very Greek, didn't penetrate Judaism. Now, there is a big exception, a very important exception, and that is called, you know the name, Philo of Alexandria, a Jew, no doubt a Jew, who wrote a huge literature in Greek, and that's very, very important, which survived the Muslim entirely, in which we have an abstract way of thinking, basically, that's called Middle Platonic. What happened to this exception? No Jew quoted ever for a millennium and a half Philo of Alexandria, which inspired a lot of Christian theology. He inspired one single Jew. To give you an Italian example, around 1600, there was a big rabbi in Venice named Leone Modena, in Hebrew, Yudare Modena. He corresponded with some Christian Hebrews, and one of them asked him the question, why don't you quote Philo of Alexandria? So his answer was very, very fascinating. He's too Platonic for us. He summarized the entire history in one sentence. That's enough for us. That's fine for you. Now, this refusal to enter in the coherence of the system, and coherence means psychology. The moment you say, Aristotle, the book De Anima, you can describe the human soul in a systematic way, with details. You believe that in fact there is an order, and that's a very important term, there's an order, which is outside the divine will. And by knowing this order, you know something very important. So that is the Greek, big Greek invention. The idea of order, which is external, objective, very important to know the order. And that is physics, cosmology, psychology. I mean, the Greeks really invented the idea of order. And that's why you can speculate, contemplate, to understand the order of the universe. The Jews, with a certain fire, refused to subscribe to order. The only order was the will of God. And will is not order. Will is unexpected, can change. It's important to know the will of God now, but it may change. So, that's also the Jewish anthropology. Not only, if you like to call it Jewish theology, it was important, the will of God, but also Jewish anthropology. What's important is the will to do, and not the will to know. God, in the Bible, is apparently not a very intelligent creator. Read the Bible, he doesn't succeed in it. He tried to educate Adam, didn't work. Tried to educate the generation after Adam, didn't work. He tried to educate the Jews, didn't work. So they had to destroy all the time. To expel Adam and Eve, to destroy the generation of the flood, to destroy the temple. That's the biblical. But he's very powerful, has a strong will. Intelligence, not so clear. Not so clear in the Bible. I mean, according to the Bible, that's not my economical vision of God. It is, in my opinion, a keen reading of the Bible by someone who believes in what is written there. Sees that simply that world doesn't matter why doesn't it. You can say it's the free will of God to give us free will. And then he's punishing us. Fine, you can describe it more in one way. I'm not interested now in speculating about it, but it is obvious that we have expulsion, destruction, the temporal or generation, those are major events. Punishment of people, you know, in the desert, and that's not a simple issue. Since I'm not a theologian, I don't have any problem to attribute to God whatever you want, the will of incoherence. So that is a lesson which any intelligent Jew reading the Bible will attain it after a while. Not all the, I would say all the Jews read the Bible. It's a small minority, but we are concerned with this small minority which reading the Bible must have the sense that the will of God is the most powerful issue and not his wisdom. So now I'm becoming a little more complex, I hope. Meaning, that is basically the biblical and to a certain extent the rabbinic attitude. You know, to know the order of the universe is not important because tomorrow God can destroy everything and start everything from the very beginning, and all your knowledge is to the close. What you should know is the manifestation of the will of God in that moment. It's the maximum, but what is even more important is to fulfill or to obey, if you like to call it in Christian terms, the will of God. He told us what to do, we are doing what he told us, and that is the maximum. The intelligence is maybe important for business or for whatever other issue, but it's not a religious stuff. It's scarcely in the Bible very difficult to find the term intellectual intelligence. That's another story which I cannot enter. When you tell me Secher in the Bible, that's different than we assume there is intellect. What's important is to love God, to fulfill, but not so much to know. Despite the fact there is one place in the Bible, or Solomon, where it's written, you should know God, but you should, afterwards it's written, actually to follow what he's telling you. So that's not a matter of knowledge, it's important, but you know in order to do. So, that is the basics of how to put the Jewish culture before the New Ages. There are a lot of discussions in rabbinic literature about how to do, almost nothing about what we call abstract theological versus speculative issues. So, in order not to be misunderstood, not that I believe the Jews were totally incapable of creating abstract systems. Philo did it very successfully. But he represented, and that is an issue that I would like to emphasize, he was living on the borderline between the Greek culture and the Jewish culture. He did it because he was replete with a Greek civilization. And he did it in Greek. That's why he was not absorbed by other Jews. Jews living in their communities didn't need a theology, didn't need a vision of the universe, because they wanted to create a civilization based on a communal life. What you do together. What you sing together. But what you do together. So that is the reason why what can be called Jewish philosophy or Jewish mysticism is relatively a late story. That we are going to discuss at length later. But why it's so belated? It's so belated because the Jews refused to enter the game. It's found in Greek philosophy, in Christian theology, in Muslim theology, for a while. And only in a certain moment there was a certain change or shift, whatever you call it, a breakdown of the nerves. The Jews entered this form of discourse. And I shall discuss it. So Philo was the first. And he, in the moment he entered the game, he did a decent job, which means he became one of the basis, if you like, of Western theology. Cited by all the great figures in Christian theology from Origen on, but also earlier. Maybe Paul was already influenced. So I assumed the Jews could do it and did it in the Middle Ages. But they refused because they had another vision of religion. So they insisted, if you like, that if you enter this game, you're not going to be ostracized. You're simply, you are not relevant for the major cultural decision of rabbinic teaching. You can become a fascinating thinker, but then you are going to be at the corner or outside the sphere of today's. Look to what happened to Spinoza. And I shall bring also other examples. But the Spinoza was a great heretic, that's not the issue. Simply, you write in a style, in a language, which is not relevant to the community. You don't tell us anything important for us. You are telling something universal. Maybe even correct. But that's not relevant. So, I hope that I'm still intelligible. So, that is the substratum of what you have called revolution or change which happened in the Middle Ages. The change, which was a dramatic one, actually a small, gradual development. It was the acceptance of a mental structure. It was alien by a very small elite, which immediately triggered a huge debate. That's why it's obvious that it's a big change. If you don't have a debate, that's a sign. It's not a change. And this debate actually changed, how to put it, the adoption of the debate changed the general structure of Judaism. Now, let me turn to some reflections about the most important term that I'm going to use here, and that is monotheism. I don't know who suggested the term, you suggested, I suggested, I don't know. But then I must explain something about monotheism before we go on. Monotheism is a very abstract term, which means from the very beginning it doesn't exist in Judaism. What I teach in Hebrew, the word I am using is monotheism. It's no Hebrew term. There's no Hebrew term in the Bible for it. Not Hebrew term in rabbinic literature. It appears in the Middle Ages. In my opinion, you don't have a term, you don't have a concept. It's not an issue that people couldn't invent a term. Would they believe that monotheism is very important? They will find a term as they found in the Middle Ages. The fact that we don't have a term in 2 millennia of Jewish history means, in my opinion, a lot. One, we don't have it because to observe. Second, it's maybe not important. So, I would like now to claim that the invention of the Jewish contribution to religion of monotheism is a late invention, which is not sustained by the Bible and not by rabbinic literature. One, no term, I insist, no term, in my opinion, no discussion, which means no concept. So we don't have a term because then this issue is not an issue. Including issues with the esoteric or they existed but it was marginal. It was not an issue. And I shall try to give you an introduction now why I believe it was not an issue, not because there is no term. I don't assume that the Bible is monotheistic, according to the Bible itself, which means that in many occasions it's written that you shouldn't have other gods, which means you shouldn't have other gods. There's not a false issue. And there is a possibility to have other gods. But the Jews are required, for reasons I'm going to describe in a moment, to believe in this God and not in other gods. It is not written, there are places written there a few times later on in prophecy. But in many important places, that you must make a choice. I'm going to describe why. Even other alternatives. And this alternative, which means, for sure, the Jews believe in a certain God, which is one. I should tell you what I believe is one. But that's not one of these. Yet a certain singling out one God among other alternatives. And worshiping him. If you like to call it monolatry, you can call it monolatry, but also too abstract. So, my assumption is that in the Bible, what we have is the famous choice. God chooses the people, and the people must follow God. One God. When you say God, it's so clear. So, what God did? The God who did a great favor to the Jews. And rescued them from Egypt. Something very clear, I assume. Meaning, the basic idea that is translated later on as monotheism is based on the assumption that when the Jews were in an extreme difficult danger of being annihilated, God intervened, saved them, and they should serve Him. And the basic issue, or the basic metaphor, is not monotheism, but God as a shepherd. Jews are his nation, and they should follow him because he did them the huge favor of rescuing him. So, the most important manifestations, in my opinion, in ancient days, up to today, in the Israeli radio, when in the morning the radio starts to broadcast, is reminding that God who saved us from Egypt is our God who should love Him. So that's an issue of remembering who did you the greatest favor and to whom we should direct our grace or recognition. That is not one of these. It is another vision. There were maybe alternatives, maybe not, that's important. But the idea is not the abstract one God, which is important, but the very concrete God who entered history and changed the history of the Jewish people. And that's why they should recognize Him and not anyone else, if they exist or don't exist, it doesn't matter. So, this idea I would like to summarize by the term of memory. We remember God. In Hebrew, it's very important, Zachor, the term of memory. We must remember Him because He did this great intervention. And that's why we belong to Him. If you like to call it choice, you can call it whatever term. The basic idea is that we shall recognize what He did. If you like to call it monotheism, I don't care, but that's not what people are claiming when they use the term monotheism. The idea is the motivation is such a universal. God of all of us, the only one. But here, the only one is the only one who intervenes. It's true. But maybe there were also other people, gods around, who didn't care, who were busy in this moment. And they didn't do anything, and to him, nothing to do with them. In fact, I would like not to enter now in biblical discussions of the existence of other gods or some form of angels, which could do, but didn't. The strongest expression of this vision was found in the Passover Haggadah, meaning what was reciting the Passover, was written in a very strong language. Only God intervened. No angel, no one did anything when the Jews exited Egypt, but God alone, and that's very important, alone. Now, alone doesn't mean this. It means a certain particularistic linkage between one God, and doesn't matter if he's the only one God, that's another story, and a certain community whose ritual should be all the time directed towards his God. Now, it's becoming a little bit more complex, so I should give you some examples in order to flesh out this thing. Not so simple to describe rituals in general, not only Jewish rituals, but in general, ritual is something you go back, what you do, but you don't always understand. But maybe that some important rituals in the Bible, and I shall give you examples, are intended to create a perpetual memory of the exit or exodus from Egypt. This is the meaning of phylacteries. This is the meaning of the talit. This is the meaning of the mezuzah put on the doors. That you should remember all the time. When you put the phylacteries, when you don't the tefillin, when you kiss the mezuzah, what should you remember? That God is, in fact, the factor which rescued us. Now, to summarize those commandments, which are not all of them, but they are very important, is to say that we must create an envelope of memory, of reminders, even in the normal life, not only in the Passover, not only during the prayer, but all the time, and the assumption is that at least the talit should be done all the time, or the mezuzah, all the time around you. And the Jews created a certain envelope, that's what I call the envelope, of reminders. And what's important here is to remind us all the time of the God who saved us. So that is my reading of the gist of the biblical practical theology. That is the divine intervention which shaped the Jews into a people. And they should all the time remember this formative moment by a series of rituals which should be performed all the time, because the memory of people is weak. People will forget. In one generation, forget what happened. And the idea is, in order not to forget, we must create some form of envelope that we are within, meaning the talit, or the phylacteries, or the mezuzah, are in a way embracing us. We should live in this envelope of reminders in such a manner that is impossible. And that is a very concrete envelope. It's an envelope of abstractness. It's an envelope which is very, very concrete. Objects which are found around you and are intended to keep in your memory in every moment. Who is the factor which saved the Jews? Because that's my understanding of how the ritual worked. It didn't work by claiming the universal God, and one God, old abstract God. All those terms are very, very nice. They are found in today's late, and we're going to discuss them, but very, very good. And I would say that 90% of the Jews didn't know them up to this point. And that's a very small minority issue that we're going to discuss at length, because it's already, you know. But you must remember that all those abstractions are basically unknown, even when people are reciting them. We're going to discuss what happens in the Jewish prayer. But that's not the issue of God is abstract or not. So, that's my starting point. That what I'm going to discuss is, in fact, a deviation from a certain major line. And this major line that I would like to insist is very, very important. Didn't disappear in religious. Didn't disappear at all. In my opinion, it is the vast majority of the Jews now. The vast majority of the Jews now are still living in this biblical rabbinic mode of thinking. And a very small minority deviated and created big systems. But those big systems, despite the fact they were codified and put in very important parts of Jewish ritual, people are reciting them, scarcely able to understand what's going on there. And they are shaped by the concrete, incoherent, associative, non-ordered form of thinking, but strongly ritualistic, intended to maintain a certain communal life. So, I define now my starting point in order to understand that what I'm telling you now from this moment on is Judaism. Because Judaism reached itself and changed, for sure. I don't say that one point of Judaism, but what I describe here, in my opinion, is a fair picture of biblical rabbinic Judaism, which didn't disappear in the first or second millennium, but remained very, very important up to this moment. Okay, so let me start with some clarifications about what can be called biblical theology, which are important to understand the changes. First, let me start with something that God in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, is anthropomorphic or anthropopathic, meaning is described as having an image, Genesis 1:26. And in his image, God created man and woman together. That's a very, very important statement, which cannot be misunderstood if someone is not biased. What is this idea of image of Tselem? It's relatively clear in scholarship about ancient Judaism. No serious scholar today would claim that Tselem is not anthropomorphic. What exactly is this form? This is another story. It has a male and female dimension. That is the real question. Not the question that it does, according to this statement, has a form. That is obvious. The problem is, what's the form of the form? But not if there's a form. So that's a very important statement. And we're going to see how important it is in the other phases of Jewish thinking. What is this Tselem or image of God? Because that is a clue for what is God. It's a clue for what is the human being. But in the Bible, if you are taking into consideration not theological assumptions, but the scholarship about engineering. Scholars agree about the issue of seven beings are homostatic. That's what scholars are saying, not one or two, and there are a lot of books about the issues, including very recent ones. So that is Genesis 1:26. You can say, okay, this one theological expression in the Bible, but I believe it's rather important. But you're going to look in Ezekiel 1:26 again. We're going to see that again there is an image or a likeness of man upon the throne. So, you have more than one expression of some form of anthropomorphism. That seems to me to be a common denominator. A lot of people, when I'm saying something like that, are coming, you know, with other parts of the Bible telling me that, look, in other parts of the Bible, it's written that God doesn't have any image. That is true also. But in the same part of the same chapter in the Bible, it's written, you cannot see my image because you're going to die, which means that there is an image. But you cannot see, which is another story. Not everything we don't see doesn't have an image. So the idea is that God doesn't have an image is a very precarious one in the Bible. Because it's written, I don't have any image. But it's written there that Moses has seen my image. Exactly the same term, Muna. Sitting. Moses has contemplated my image. The term contemplate is not a good one, as we're going to see later on. But that is written in the same chapter. So, this idea of the invisible God, spiritual God, maybe someone can detect it somewhere in the Bible. Maybe. But that's not the leading approach in the Bible. So, God has a lot of pathos. That's one good way to understand the biblical theology. It is pathetic. But in the, how to put it, in a more noble sense of it. And one of the most important modern Jewish theologians, Avraham Yeshua Heschel, believes that the pathos is one of the most important dimensions of the biblical vision of God, which I believe is a true one. That's again not invisible, that God has a pathos, has an emotion. That we know, in any case, by reading the Bible, God is sometimes nervous about what's going on here around, and he's expressing his anger very openly. That's the anthropopathic vision. So, the Bible is, in the way I described earlier, much more concrete. We have a personality, and that's very important. Not only having the form. The form is related also to some form of personality, which includes the will, and the pathos, and the form. So that's why the term personality is important. What is very important is not just personality, but a dynamic personality. Now, I cannot make a psychoanalysis of God, as some people attempt to do, because I don't believe that we can analyze, scarcely can analyze someone alive. Someone, you know, acting some 2,000 years ago, we're a little more complex. So I don't enter now what personality is there. There are people attempting to do it, but I don't, you know, indulge in this form of speculations. But that seems to me to be the very important approach of the Bible. It's not a simple statement, and not a simple personality. It's a much more dynamic one, and that's very, very important. Now, the first Jewish theology of Philo of Alexandria is raising those visions of God. Meaning God is portrayed, according to Philo, in Platonic terms. He is a logos. He is a mind, or he is unknown. All those issues, which are not found in the Hebrew Bible, are attributed the Hebrew Bible by Philo, who was a philosopher, who attempted to explain Judaism to Dallas. And that's why he imported the Platonic worldview into his commentaries on the Bible. So that's an issue which should be clarified, that later forms of Judaism in the Middle Ages had to cope with this issue from the very first chapter of the Bible. And it's not someone, you know, write chapter 25 and you must deal with the first chapter of the Bible. That's a statement that is not a simple one for a philosopher, for someone who believes that what's important in person and God is the intellectual part, the spiritual part. And then efforts are made to undermine this corporeality, anthropomorphism, by attributing to the term tselem, a meaning which is not found ever in Hebrew. We're going to speak about it later today. So, here we have stumbling blocks. In the Bible, for a philosopher, to tell you the highest principle in the world is human-like, creates a very strong tension. And that's why philosophy, when entering Judaism, created immediately a tension. Not an easy adoption. Well, things are imported so neatly. You say, okay, some Jews had, because philosophy has one, how to put it, very strong inclination. It is attempting to be prescriptive. Philosophers had the feeling that the truth is theirs, from their theologies come. Philosophers are always right. Plato was more correct than others, and Aristotle was more correct than Plato, and all the philosophers up to today, they believe that all the other philosophers in the history of philosophy, all of them are wrong. And only they are correct. So, have a look to history of philosophy, you see that's an history of despotism. Someone believes that he found the principle, and all the others are all totally wrong, or to a very extent, obsolete. That's why the history of philosophy is a history of attempts to impose a new vision on all the other old visions. So when you import it into a religion, it's the same vision. We have the final answer. That is the only way to understand. All the other ways are erroneous or heretical. And that's why tensions emerge. Philosophy is not an issue of giving you a nice explanation we have done that earlier. It is an issue which assumes that there is one truth, and what happens to the text of the Bible when this one truth is imposed is the text of the Bible is misinterpreted. Philosophy is a history of misinterpretation in general, and that's even more obvious in the history of biblical understanding. If the philosophers are doing it bona fide or not, that's a long story. That's not simple to give you an answer. If philosophers knew they misinterpreted, or they were naive enough not to know what they are doing. So we shall speak a little bit later about my knowledge, but that is the history of interpretation by philosophers. Imposing misinterpretations because they came with another set of values. And they were totally convinced that that set of values is the most important one. And what happened to the earlier set of values is really a problem. They could say that they're only, or they could say that there is. There were important philosophers who said that there is. That in fact the Bible interpreted on the plain sense is heresy. We'll discuss it later, but that's very important to describe what the meaning of such a meaning. That's not simple meaning. That
that there exist
two Jewish philosophies is a big enrichment into this. But at the same time, the enrichment by speaking from the philological point of view, from the historical point of view, that is sharp misinterpretation. Attempting to claim that what all the others are thinking up to a certain moment, everything is futile. So that's why we have all the time debates when philosophy entered to this. That's Philo, in which the rabbis were clever enough not to debate, simply to ignore it. But that's also debate. But that's a rabbinic form of debate. If you don't like it, simply don't mention it. It's called to kill someone by silence. Compare this vision to the way in which the fathers of the church dealt with heresy. The fathers of the church, they were quoting and then refuting, refutatio heresies. That's an interesting strategy. But this saved all those Gnostics, and we know about them from where? From the fathers of the church. The rabbi said another politics. Simply don't mention him at all, don't debate. At a certain moment, the rabbi started to debate, and we're going to speak about the Middle Ages, but that is when philosophy enters, since Middle Ages up to today, we have the same strategy. The rabbis attempted to debate now, and to show that philosophy is alien. It was an Italian Jewish historian who wrote a very nice book named Alien Wisdom, Momiliasco. Alien Wisdom. He wrote about other issues, about the Greeks. But the term Alien Wisdom is very interesting for the history of Jewish philosophy. That's the way in which the rabbis called Jewish philosophy. Alien Wisdom. I don't know if he knew or didn't know, or he knows this term. Emiliano, yes. Maybe the most important Jewish historian ever in Piemont, at least. No, there was one more important Jewish historian in Italy. I don't know if you know the name. More important than Emiliano, than Giuseppe Flavius. I'm sure he was more important. But the most important is for sure Emiliano. And he wrote this book, Alien Wisdom. And that's for rabbis in Hebrew, this expression exists. Chokhmah Chitzonit, exactly alien wisdom. I'm not sure that Mundiano knew, despite the fact that he knew Hebrew, but a relatively good Jewish culture. Okay, so there is a tension, and this tension is not a matter of my analyzing what's going on there. Not a phenomenological remark. That is a social remark. Because we have big controversies that we're going to discuss. In the moment, philosophy entered and attempted to impose a certain set of value which was abstract, sublime, speculative order that we discussed that. Now, the other issue that I would like to mention, and now I'm speaking not about the Hebrew Bible, but I'm talking about the rabbinic literature. So that's a little bit more complex, and I must do it slowly, not to be misunderstood. My assumption is, which I gave expression to it in the books, not an issue that I'm now inventing for you or science book, that there was an ancient taste. Not one theology, but a theology, one among others. But this theology remained important in the Middle Ages too, which I would like to call it binitarian or deteistic. One of the terms I take from Kuliak. What does it mean? That some Jewish rabbis, I don't speak about heretics, not to be misunderstood. I don't speak about heretics. I'm speaking about a rabbinic view, which assumed that God has some form of representative. which is considered to be divine, semi-divine. Not always clear. And in a way or another, also this second God, if you like to call it, is worshipped today. You can say that you never heard about this. That's true. But I believe this vision is found also in Christianity in a different form, in the Declaration of this kind of difference. But that was not an innovation in Judaism. And this vision found in rabbinic literature, including in the Talmud, was marginalized because of the success of Christianity. But when Christianity be so successful, it will remain as one of the visions of Judaism, one of them. In fact, that's a book written by a scholar of the Talmud, Daniel Boyari, who claims that it was the theology of the rabbis. He is a very important scholar in rabbinics. I believe that he grossly exaggerated. I thought that he's supposed to be wrong. So, this vice God, however you have to call it, had different names in Jewish rabbinic theology. It's called glory, the glory of God, which is a manifestation of God. Or in Hebrew, Kavod. It's called Shekhinah, another, the divine presence. In my opinion, it's called also the Son of God. The Son of God. In Hebrew, Ben or Bar. So we have a variety of terms because it was not a collective theology. But some rabbis had some ideas which no one cared about them because it's a private story. So from time to time you see it here and there in rabbinic literature. Rabbis were not insulted by it because it didn't matter too much. It's a personal story. I don't say that was the common vision of the rabbis because there was no common vision. But that remained important in religious, and that I'm going to discuss much more. What is the difference between this binitarian vision and the Christian binitarian vision? To make it clear that we don't speak about some crypto Christian views. For Christianity, there's one simple form of binitarians. That is God and the Messiah, which is Jesus. But there's no way to move aside from it because it became a religion. For the rabbis, you can call it by whatever name. The Messiah was not the most favorable name for this power. There were other names, including the Son. But this Son could be fulfilled by a variety of figures, which means that for the Jews, the box was open. In Christianity, it was already full. You cannot enter the box. There's one unitarian power, and then Jesus Christ, and there's no way to, you know, to replace it. That to replace it will be total heresy. In Judaism, it is a little bit more complex. So, it's not so theological, so you can imagine that it's called divine glory, and it's glory and not anthropomorphic, or it can be a light, it can be a sun, it can be an angel, you don't speak about the angel, it's like the name, Metatron, etc. Which is, how to put it, normal Judaism in rabbinic text. For sure, some people can make a mistake, misunderstand it, and the rabbi considers it a mistake, in our opinion. Again, we have discussions about something like that, but I would like not to enter on this issue, but to tell you that rabbinic literature is not a simple literature, having one single God, that's much, much more complex. In rabbinic literature, we have an invasion of angels, for example, which is not found in the Bible. A lot of hierarchies creating the new landscape. So that seems to me to be very, very important to mention. Rabbinic literature becomes a little bit more open from the point of view of the theological landscape, despite the fact that it's not a theology. And leaving room for angels, glory, Son of God, Shekhinah, which is feminine, all those issues are entering, and not big debates are related to it. In a way, that's how to put it, that's an opinion. You can debate it, but it's not an heresy. That's very important. That's a wrong opinion. The rabbis were not very, how to put it, interested in heresies. In Judaism, it's very difficult to become an heretic. You must make big efforts. And only few people succeed. And only by, how to put it, by historical accidents that someone is able. Spinoza, you know, he took advantage of the fact that the rabbi was not there around. He was in London. So that's why he became a heretic. Otherwise, he won't become a heretic. I mean, it's very, very difficult to become a heretic in Judaism. So, Sabbatai Tzvi also didn't want to become a heretic. Otherwise, so, the fact that someone has this theology or another, you know, people can despise, can say that he's crazy, but to become a heretic without having the dogma is very difficult. Without having the Pope, who is going to tell you that you are a heretic, you are a heretic. So, that's very important to see this. It's not pluralism. I will persist. That is simply a certain indifference. Those issues are not so important. You know, that's room for deliberations, for discussions. You are majority or minority, that doesn't make any difference. So, to return to this issue of Binitarian, which seems to be very important, because from such a Binitarian line, Christianity emerges. Christianity claims all the time that that's a Jewish reading of the Bible. I believe to a great extent it is true. It's also misleading, because it's introducing a certain specific person as the only protagonist of the Bible, which for sure, in my opinion, for the Hebrew Bible is not true. But there is something in Christianity in which the assumption that it's a little bit more complex than one single God, which remained injured in rabbinic literature and became very important later on. So you see, that creates not a single reading of the Bible. This, the philosophers didn't like it, as we're going to see. The philosophers were interested in one single God, the sublime one, which cannot have anything like another vice God or prison. Nevertheless, what seems to me to be important in the impact of this Binitarian vision of God is that in rabbinic literature we have a Binitarian vision of the person. Which means that in many, many forms of rabbinic Judaism, the human is presented as having two different instincts or urges, or yetzarim, or yetzer. And religious life is a battle between the two instincts in man. That seems to me very important, more important than the theology. That on the anthropological level, this Binitarian vision is represented strongly, much more than the, on the theological, in the vision of man, that man is the arena of a battle between two different instincts, and that is actually the nature of religion, to be able to overcome one's instinct by imposing another. So for me, Binitarian is not some form of marginal theology. It's true that it's a marginal theology. But it contributed a very important vision to religious life by describing the religious life as a battle or as a war. Again, I cannot enter in all those issues, between two instincts in a man. And that is very pronounced in our language. Because it's not just at once that I see the world. I see the world something much more than at once. So that's an issue that, again, I'm going to speak about later on. God has two divine attributes, according to other theologians. Rabbinic theologies, midot, two divine attributes, which correspond in many to divine and to, excuse me, human instincts or yetzarim. So there's certain consonance between a unitarian vision and an anthropological vision, which man is supposed to impose the will on something found in himself in order to reach some form of what can be called perfect beauty. Now, and here I'm arriving to another very important aspect of rabbinic and biblical theology, which is going to preoccupy us a lot. And that is the issue of perfection and imperfection. Greek God in philosophy, I don't speak about mythology, is perfect God. It is very intellectual and transcendental, self-sufficient, with the exception of the Stoa, cannot enter now in all this issue. But God is the idea of perfection. This perfection is intellectual, it's not aesthetical, it's not even not ethical in Greek. It is simply intellectual. So the intellect is the most important issue for a philosopher. So, for a philosopher, the God is also a philosopher, to make it very simple. But he is an archi-philosopher, doesn't make mistakes, and, you know. He has all his system of contemplation within himself. That's how he started, and that is Plato. This idea of perfection doesn't correspond to anything, in my opinion, in biblical or rabbinic theology. God is not perfect. I said, I don't know if he's wise enough. This idea of having a God which is transcendent and intellectual and self-sufficient is not biblical and not rabbinic, in my opinion. If someone will ask me what is the single contribution of Judaism to the modern, how to put it, Western vision of that, it's not perfection but imperfection. In a moment, describe one. That seems to me to be the major contribution. While the Greek contribution is the idea of perfection, which was then accepted also by Jewish theologians. And that created one of the most important tensions. Morphism and Anthropopathism are imperfections for philosophy. So, what happened is the two basic different ideas. The imperfect God of the Bible are very powerful and revealing and choosing and reacting. Encounter another cultural value which was also very powerful, and there was a huge clash to the two. That is the history of Jewish theology in one sentence. Not either or either, meaning we have in Judaism we have the adoption of the idea of perfection in the Middle Ages and modern philosophy. But that is all the time grafted on documents dealing with the idea of imperfection. And that creates the unique problem. I would like to enter now in comparison to Christian theology, which has something also very, very similar. But that's a little bit not in the context of that discussion. But this meeting seems to me to be the most interesting from the intellectual point of view, development, that the Jewish idea of an imperfect life, who needs man, and that is the other issue that I want to explain now, since he is imperfect, he needs someone to help him. And this someone is man or the Jew. In Greek philosophy, God doesn't need anyone, even not Aristotle. Aristotle's God doesn't need Aristotle. Plato's God doesn't need him. He's there, he's here, you know, impassible. Doesn't matter if Plato's going to see him or not to see him. That's also the case with Aristotle and Neoplatonic philosophy, and Neo-Aristotelian philosophy. God being perfect doesn't need us. We need him, but he doesn't need us. To a certain extent in the biblical theology, but for sure in Talmudic or rabbinic theology, God needs man. I shall give you some examples because they are very important. And that is part of the understanding of rabbinic Jews. That, you know, what's going on is not so perfect. And maybe you can do something. We can help you out to have a better world. And not to live it only to this imperfection. So what seems to me to be basic for rabbinic, for the, you know, the Hebrew Bible is a bit more complex. But for rabbinic today, it is obvious that men must cooperate, and to a very great extent, the cooperation is strict necessary. You know, a nice contribution. Meaning, it is strict necessary. In order to complete this world. This world as in itself is not going to be complete. So maybe we can help God. So that is the great insight, if you ask me, that rabbinic Judaism had from reading the Hebrew Bible. Not that God is incomplete, but that we can help him. And this help is the ritual. Don't help him by giving him advices what to do. But helping him by doing, not by thinking. That's very important. Not that we can attempt to offer him some intellectual benefits. That's not important, I told you, intellectual issue. But simply by living a certain form of life, which is believed to have a contribution to the order of the world. The term order, don't take it too strong. The rabbis believe that we can help God. So that's a very strong theological statement. If you like, that's the most important theological statement I can elicit from Rabbi Yehuda. Mean something very, very meaningful for the rabbis. That will be theological. Something very meaningful. In that man was taught a certain way of life, which is considered to be perfect, perfect. That is perfect, not God. But the way of life of man, because the Torah was considered to be perfect. That's it in the Bible. The Torah of God is perfect. That is perfect. So by following a certain perfect way of life, we can help the imperfect God, not to improve this world. So that seems to me to be a very strong assumption, which again contradicts the philosophical Greek approach, in which God doesn't need us at all. Not now, not in the future, not in the eschatological future, we cannot do this. The order, you remember, is going to remain the same. If we do something, we don't do anything, that is a universal, cosmological, final world. While in a theology in which the will of God, which is so shaky, we We can cooperate. We can improve and change and repair. It's very important. Repair. Because we have a tool. And this tool is a certain way of life which is conceived to be meaningful. Now, I don't know what I am going to stop.
Half past 12.
Not
you. All the same.
So, tell me when to stop. So, we stop now.
I must know the time.
It's a quarter to 12.
It's a quarter to 12.
No, we have time. And then, if you said at 12 or more or less.
Tell me, so just tell me.
Okay, I make you a list.
You can go. No. Quarter an hour, half an hour.
Half an hour.
Yes. So, fine, I would like to give you the time to reflect, to correct me, to repair, to whatever. So, that seems to me to be quintessential for understanding what happened in the Middle Ages. This idea, which I'm going to describe in a moment more, of contribution, reparation, improvement, which has not only a communal for sure, no doubt, but it has an objective power to repair the world. To a certain extent, maybe to repair God. To a certain extent, about this, I'm going to speak much more about what's going on in Kabbalistic theology, which is very important. So here we have the discovery of rabbis looking back to the Hebrew Bible, seeing that it didn't work, you know. It's very nice that God chose us, you know, had all the good intentions. Without us, that don't work. So, it's not only a matter of exile or the national. That is true, it has some reverberations of finishing the exile. Restoring the old days. It's true, but that's much more than it is a discovery, to use Italian terms, of the dignity of man. Man is not just one small particle of the universe, which, you know, is born and dying and can perfect himself. But that's his business. Man is something much more important by his
doing with the God.
Okay. By his activity, I'd like to emphasize, which is ritualistic activity and not intellectual activity. Man is capable of changing reality. So if you ask me what is the source of people on the Angola, I have my answer, but maybe you can discuss it much later. Not a very Italian stuff. So, that seems to me to be the implication of what I discussed earlier. The implication is not that man should obey alone. It's true. But the obeisance, the performance is important much beyond the individual perfection or invention. Someone should perform not only because he's afraid to be in hell, but because there is something broader and more important that is related to performance. Or to put it now again in one word, the two major forms of classical Judaism, biblical and rabbinic, are performative forms of religion, in which the performance is the same. You don't do, you are lost. And it doesn't matter how intelligent you are, how much do you believe in God. To speak about the two major alternatives, the philosopher and the Christian. That's very nice. For sure you should be intelligent, study hard. For sure you should believe in God. But that's not enough. Because God doesn't ask you to believe. The faith asks you to do. So, to a very great extent, the two major forms of Judaism, including the reverberation up to today, is a performative religion, in which all the other parts, the intellectual one, the emotional one, don't harm, but they are not the center. So I attempted to summarize what seems to me to be the basics from which the medieval Judaism attempted now to offer an intensification or a neutralization, depends on the system, of the classical forms of Judaism. Philosophers attempted to neutralize a lot of things like deeds, which are corporeal and helpful maybe for the intellect, but the intellect is much more important than anything. Emotional, for sure, not so important for philosophy. Okay, emotion should be controlled. What's important is for the rabbis, and not for the philosophers, is the need or the urgence of performance. So here we have a tension that I try to build up, if you like, between the Greek philosophers, who none of them created ever one single small community. One single small community. In my opinion, it's true for philosophers since Pythagoras up to today, that they have some few disciples, but not a community. And the rabbis, who didn't care about philosophies, but they were interested in communities. So communities are based on common denominators, which is a performance done together in a certain place, in a certain moment. What I would call synchronization. The ritual is based on performance which is synchronized. You don't just do or just agree. You must do it in a certain way, in a certain moment, in a certain place, together with others. Philosophy is a highly individualistic activity which can be done, doesn't matter when and where, alone. You don't need anyone else, you know, to be a philosopher. Maybe the other can disturb you. So, what happened? Those two cultural basic issues, which competed in for, I would say, a millennium and a half, after the beginning of the millennium, in Judaism, so completed by Plato, by Philo, or by the rejection of the rabbis. In a certain moment, there was a faithful meeting, which created what is called Jewish theology, or Jewish philosophy, but created a lot of other issues, reaction to them, which enriched dramatically the classical forms of Judaism by adopting new forms of thinking and reactions to the new forms of thinking, which are also new, and created the fact that Judaism as we know today, to a very great extent, the picture I give you is not recognized today by anyone. For sure not the Orthodox Judaism, which they are assimilated to a very great extent, because they believe to a very great extent that Maimonides is true, but also the Bible is true, and all of them are true. Or by other, how to put it, presentation of Judaism as universal and moralistic and having a message for the world and universal Judaism, which are a variety of visions which, in my opinion, do not recognize the important revolution which took place in the Middle Ages. A revolution which didn't succeed to a very great extent as a failure, if we speak statistically. If we speak intellectually, it was a big success. Because, as the way in which Judaism is portrayed by many philosophers, and that's the way in which many people from outside Judaism believe that it's Judaism. They are going to tell you that Judaism is monotheistic and intellectual and I don't know what. those are clichés which are the result of the huge success of Greek philosophy to impose an agenda within Judaism and the Jewish elite to buy it and disseminate it in a variety of forms, I'm going to speak. So that's why I believe we can speak about the new sense of what is religious in the Middle Ages, which I summarize by the term exclusive religious. It's a one religious. While the classical forms of the Bible and the Rabbinic literature and the literature I'm going to discuss, the Kabbalistic literature, are another form of monotheism, if you like to call monotheism, inclusive monotheism. So those are the, how to put it, the two lines that I'm going to discuss. How Jewish philosophy imposed this exclusive form. One God, one vision, heresy, all the others are out. And the reaction to it by formulating an inclusive, in which you, the philosophers, we don't like it, but we can live with your vision by including you, not by excluding you as an heretic, which would be the adoption of the philosophical vision or the theological vision of Christianity by creating heresies. But ideas are, you know, like in the famous Jewish joke, you are right and we are right. We are all of us right. Let's create some form of coexistence in which things which are simply possible, incompatible, are made compatible. So that is what I call the inclusive theology, which could allow a variety of variants that include more and more and more and more. More we learn, more we include. Up to moments, which I hope at the end of my discussions here, to show you issues in which you cannot give you a number of the powers which are envisioned to be divine, meaning I don't know this number because you can't do it. Meaning, so that's a move away from the monotheistic, simplistic vision of one God and some form of monad. But, you know, if you know it, you know. Meaning the other vision is multiplication generation after generation, up to powers more and more and more and more and more, with one condition, that we are able to unify them. Not there are many, 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 many gods. There are many, many divine powers that we should unify them. And that's another form of monotheism. That's why I think about monotheism, because it's not just plurality. The plurality which invites a certain form of cooperation and of unification of God, which is one because we are unifying Him. That's why the ancient rabbinic tendency of unification or cooperation or improvement of reparation is so important. Because theologically speaking, Kabbalistic theology was moving all the time in the direction of multiplication. So more you are multiplying God, more you must that it be to mend the power to repair. When God is one and doesn't need you, you are nothing. When God is so polarized or multiplied, in fact the human activity is much more central. And that's, how to put it, the counterpart of the inclusive vision. Inclusive vision includes not only many divine powers, but the power of men to manipulate those powers. So, now I hope that you understand at least what are the parameters of my discussion. My parameters are not that I'm going to disclose you the real Jewish theology, which I don't know. I'm going to speak with you about the major vectors with a lot of holes, because I don't have time, in which we can see how the exclusive form of which I'm going to discuss in a moment, reaction, and then how, by reacting to this exclusive form, an increasing form, and then this battle between them, which can be easily documented by bringing you whatever prayer book you can imagine. I am going to show you how in the prayer book, which is the most popular and most important Jewish book, not the Bible, used by Jews every day, not like the Bible we read from time to time. There you can see the two vectors. In the prayer book, we have the inclusive, we have the exclusive, different some pages, etc. And both of them are recited every day, bona fide by the Jews, which don't care that it's contradictory, it doesn't work. But that's part of the ritual, and that was more important. Not that you understand what's going on there, but you accept this one, you accept the other one. So that we're going to see, I don't know if I shall have the opportunity to bring you a prayer book. You see how many of it is, one page, speaking about, you know, other God, the other page you have something totally different, also excited, without any problem. So that is, in a way, the victory of the inclusive vision. That in the most popular Jewish book, the two tendencies are represented in a very, very clear way by, how to put it, very clear statements of one page in each case, not one sentence. So here, that's exactly what I shall try to show to you. How exclusive is exclusive, and how inclusive is inclusive. Okay, so now, we have a break. Oh no, it's like, I hope that you, I believe that I was clear, and there's no place for discussion.
You tell us about the imperfection of God.
Oh,
the imperfection,
yes,
of God, and then about the perfection of the Torah. So,
yes,
how did the rabbis deal with this foreign paradox? I mean, how can something perfect came from someone that is not perfect?
That's a Greek question. Look, I'm telling you what's written in the Bible. I didn't tell you that it's true. Or this compatible. What I'm telling you in the Bible is written the Torah of God is complete or perfect. Torah Hashem Himba. That's written there. You can say that's impossible or that's a mistake. It's written that God's deeds are perfect. The deeds are not God. So people don't speak, the speech of God is not so important. So your question is a very nice question. But that invites a certain order. A perfect being is creating a perfect effect. Either effect is perfect, so also the source is perfect. It's a very nice syllogism. In Greek. But just to adopt a certain approach. So I can't explain you something like that because I'm not attempting to make sense. I spoke about profound incoherence, truth. So how can I make sense if I believe it's profound incoherence? You can say that's nonsense. Okay. I have a problem. But I don't attempt to offer now harmonization. Tell you, let's think about it. Let's find in the Bible somewhere where God is perfect. Maybe someone can show me. But that's, for me, a futile exercise. I have nothing against Greek philosophy, but it seems to me that the Bible didn't play this game. And I would like to impose this game on the Bible by attempting to offer theodicy or something like that. Yes, it's an interesting question based on a certain form of logic, which I don't believe is the logic of the Hebrew Bible. So, I'm sorry about this.
No.
Yes.
In the Torah, there is the...
You must speak louder because...
Sorry. In the Torah, there is the sentence, you must be holy because I'm holy.
Yes.
That is like, say, you must be perfect because I'm perfect.
What's the question? I know what you're speaking about, so what is the question?
You must formulate the question.
The question is in this sentence, yes, there is the idea of perfection of God in the Torah.
That's not so sure. Okay, so God is described as being holy. The problem is that we don't know what is holy. We have theories about, by theologians, about what is the holiness of God. So there are many theologians who tell you that holiness is perfection, a new deep expression for such a thing. Not so clear. So let's analyze the term in Hebrew. It is kadosh. Yes. What means kadosh? Kadosh is not so clear in Hebrew. So, very important philosopher of religion based all his system on this idea of kadosh, Rudolf Otto. That's all his career is built on the understanding that kadosh is different, not perfect. Dramatically different, categorically different, than the numinous. So, unfortunately, his Hebrew was very poor. And he didn't know that kadosh has more than one meaning in Hebrew, and the meaning he attributed is for sure not the most important one. Which means that kadosh, according to many discussions in the Bible, and that's not my view, that people reacted to Otto after he published his book on kadosh, yes, on Dauri, and shown that kadosh means also a relationship. Like in the text, he is holy, we are also holy. That's a relationship. That's not transcendental. We cannot become transcendental. What does it mean? We should be transcendental. So, that's not so easy to say that, look, we have here in Tatio Dei, I should speak about in Tatio Dei, believe me, more later. It's not simple in Tatio Dei, perfection versus perfection. That's the vision adopted by a very great scholar. But that's a Christian reading. And I would like not to enter. I can give you a lecture, I believe, on this issue. Why did he introduce it? And when and how? And that. But that is simply a misunderstanding. If you're going to read papers which reacted to the movement of holiness by Buber and by someone like Berkovich, they easily wrote a series of texts in the Bible in which holy means relationship. Now, I can give you a whole lecture, if you like, on the holiness in Kabbalah, in which holiness is something you create. Holiness is not transcendental. What you create by performance. So that's for sure not perfection in the sense of an objective external reality, but something different. So my answer is, let's say for a moment that Rudolf Otto maybe can find a moment here. Maybe, not so sure, according to studies by people who knew Hebrew very well, it doesn't work. So if you ask me about the Bible, I have no problem with it. But the photo, that's another story. Someone who wanted to build, and I would like not to analyze now, we are influenced by basically the photo. But if I want to analyze with you, Rudolf Otto, the beginning and the middle and the end of the book, read first 5 pages, the middle 5 pages, the last 5 pages, we're going to see his confessing that's a Christian vision. For sure, he would like to attribute it to the Hebrew Bible, that's true. But what he's saying, and not what I'm saying, for sure he is convinced that that is the vision, which is basically Kantian vision, or neo-Kantian vision, with this unknown, the noumen, and we are seeing only the phenomenon, that Kant believes, not Hebrew Bible, that Kantian vision of religion applied to the Hebrew Bible. And Kant was a very nice guy, but he wasn't an expert in the Bible. He offered the vision of reality, which was then imposed on the Bible. And we believe just the Bible. So then my angelic users think about images. That's an example of the image. A lot of what is presented at Judaism in a positive sense, I wrap themselves in a positive sense, are cliches created in the late 18th, 19th century, imposing a variety of philosophers. So one is Kant, and the other one is Hegel, and there are many, many others. And we assume that they were so clever, you know, already in the Bible they had this form of transcendentalism and moralism and the world. So, not more. In the moment you impose on a collection of writings one vision, you are wrong from the very beginning. That's my philosophy in general. That's my philosophy. Don't generalize. There's nothing which is universal, general, total. It's very important. Learn something from history. Totalitarianism, that's totalitarianism. To tell you that something, one single issue, is the truth, has a lot of problems, which can be called by a variety of ideologies which attempted to do it and failed. That has to do with a certain impulse, which I call philosophical, but they became ideological afterwards. And impose one issue, that's the good one, the only good one, everything else is false, heretical, wrong, obsolete. So, I don't get general answers for anything, for sure not for theology.
Well, I have a couple questions actually. One thing is that the idea that I'm getting from your, from what you say, is that these people thought according to completely different patterns to the ones that we are used to. Your answer to the question, that's a great question, resound very deeply within me.
Yes.
And I'm reminded of nothing so much as of reading Kafka. No, the question is not about Kafka. that would start out.
I understand you. Yeah.
That would start out maybe a
week. It's not Kafka.
Yeah. But I would be very interested in knowing whether anybody has attempted to elucidate these different thought patterns in a systematic way.
Yes, that's true. So let me answer you first on Kafka.
Uh-huh.
And then I shall. Second part, I agree with you. With Kafka, I don't agree. Kafka was a Jew who didn't know about the place almost, and he attempted to learn. He wanted to see some place about Jewish issues, and attracted him for a while. But Kafka is simply Kafka. He's too big, you know, in order to reduce him to Judaism. So what's the problem? I know, but hey, I'm answering you. So I would like to, you know, to use your question in order to elucidate something deep. For Kafka, the world was simply opaque. Doesn't matter what you do, you're out. All the efforts are not going to amount to anything. You are, in a way, going to be punished. Doesn't matter what you do. So, with Kafka, you have a strong feeling of nonsense. You could call it absurd, call it that. There is something outside that we cannot understand. And we are fighting with it, but not going to help. That's not the way I describe biblical or rabbinic Judaism. First, we have a way of life which is transparent, and that makes sense if we're speaking about sense from the point of view of performance and not from the point of view of understanding. What you do is perfect. You're not going to be punished because of it. You're not going to become a member of, you know, of the punishment colony, a Kafka. You're not going to become an insect. All those issues are the invention of Kafka, which I confess are incredibly interesting and maybe incredibly contributing to another vision of the universe. But that's not this. Not the way I described this. The classical, what I said, yes, to describe this in terms belonging to Greek philosophy or idea of coherence doesn't work because they didn't think in those terms. And that means that they were thinking in half a couple of years. But what is fascinating that some Jewish thinkers claim that Kafka is really Judas as one of the ways to demonstrate that Judas is meaningful is to say that they're absurd. Because today absurd sounds nice. So Kafka became the symbol of today's look to Sharon. Kafka, the great discovery, finally we know what Kabbalah is. That absurd, absurd. That seems to me to be a total misreading of Kafka and a misreading of Judaism. So, you know, I don't say, you know, I'm using your question to clarify something, not to argue. I don't say that you said. But this is very important to make this distinction. The fact that someone doesn't accept the Greek coherence doesn't mean that his life or his vision of the world is nonsense. From his point of view, it makes a lot of sense. For Kafka, it doesn't make sense. For Kafka, we are lost without any possibility to find a sense. So, from this point of view, my description is anti-Kafka. In fact, this book was published here. I don't mean to present my book, but this book is ending with attempting to show that Kafka was wrong. In Kafka was a passive guy. The forms of Judaism I'm discussing with him are positive. We have a way. I don't say that it's the true explanation of reality, but I'm saying that the Kabbalists didn't believe in something like Kafkaian vision, which was attributed to him, to Judaism. So, I describe something which is difficult to describe because it's difficult to describe performance in general and difficult to describe rituals because they make another sense of life rather than systems, intellectual systems. And here there's a certain opacity. But the communities I'm describing were living in this order, not in another order. What can I tell you? I cannot. I would like not to give you explanations. I shall deal with explanations when I'm going to deal with the why. The why is an explanation. I'm going to speak with it. And that's what is new in Judaism. The people start now to make sense in new terms of what they are doing. But now I attempted not to enter in this game because it would be premature. In the afternoon I should start making sense. Into those thinkers, not this. But for sure, it's not a Kafkaesque word. Kafka is indeed very modern. And as a Jew who lost his interest in the ritual, he was living on the borderline, it's Prague. Working here and looking there, being not here, not there. He needed a system. His system was absurd. Just his system. But that's someone who was living on the borderline. From this point of view, there's no difference between Kafka and Philo. Right? You remember, I insist it all the time. People who wrote in Hebrew or Aramaic didn't have this sense. Kafka wrote in German. Very poor German. But the German, after all. And that was the borderline. I'm going to speak much more about this concept of borderline. Kafka is a big example, maybe the most important example of someone who maybe saw that he's expressing the best. That I don't say that no, maybe, it's not so clear, but let's say that he attempted to express some conflict with Rabbi Nachman of Ratzra, it doesn't matter now. Rabbi Zwenter is the great. But even if he attempted to describe Judaism, the Judaism he explained had nothing to do with what happened in Eastern Europe, for example. So Rabbi Zwenter now discussions Kafka in a discussion he had with a friend of his. He understood, he was not an unintelligent person. He understood that what he's saying is something very different from Judaism. So he's in one of the discussions, he's saying, I would like to go to the ghetto of Eastern European Jews, and they will embrace me, I shall embrace them, and we shall be, both of us, silent. So that's the misunderstanding. What he took to get all, he was going to find silence. He came from another culture, and silence was the same. So we should embrace this other, and we should be silent. So that's what he didn't understand. So today's with the ghetto is not silence. People will laugh, will pray, will shout, or whatever. Not be silent. So, Kafka is the Judaism of the borderline in 20th century Central Europe. People who were no more Jews, but non-Europeans. He would like to be both of them, or none of them. So he remained on this neutral place, in which you don't know about what you left, and you are not accepted in what you would like to be accepted. So, Kafka is a big symbol for me to demonstrate how Judaism changed. And for me, if you like to include Kafka in Judaism, I have no problem. We are very great honors, if you ask me personally. Kafka was so much beyond whatever that the genius that for sure could enrich not only Judaism, could enrich the world. But if he's an expression of the earlier forms of Judaism, I doubt very much. But I don't negate the possibility to add him to Judaism. If he claims that it's Judaism, for me, it would be Judaism on the spot. I don't exclude anyone. So people would say that is Judaism, it's fine, okay. So we have one more form of Judaism, no problem. So I hope that the answer to your question is very important to understand that not all the nonsenses are the same. Meaning, like, not all the symphonies are the same. Not all the cacophonies are the same. Also, not all the nonsenses are the same. There are different forms of nonsenses, which may have a sense for people. Go to whatever, you know, India in the reservation. You see how much sense you find there, you don't understand. See, that's crazy. But for those people, it makes a lot of sense. I am not here to judge what is the real sense. We believe that we have the real sense. But that's, you know, that's a small illusion, or big illusion, how do I like to make it? That's a small form of thinking, which is considered to be universal, because it has success in many, many, in many domains, science, for example. But if you go to India, you'll see that, you know, that's nonsense. But that's my view is, I don't judge. I don't say what is better or worse. I try to understand. And to understand something like that is a difficult task, as you said at the beginning, is very difficult. But to reduce everything to what I know and to tell you that that is what's written there, it's a waste of my time. To tell you that Judaism is what Aristotle said, or what Kant said, it's a waste of time. What is fascinating is to see the difference, to be able to describe the difference. Also the commonalities, I don't have any problem with it, we're going to discuss. But understanding differences seems to me to be the most fascinating aspect. That people who are traveling thousands of kilometers to see a small community which is going to disappear, not to describe it, because that's different.
I don't get to travel with so much. I can open some books and go into Jerusalem to Mea Shearim, which is a difference. So to do the interesting thing. Yes.
Je vais poser les questions en français, mais deux petites questions. L'une, c'est sur le fait que vous avez dit de l'importance du faire, hein, de la performance. Alors, je me demande si cela dérive aussi du fait qu'il y a une forte empreinte cosmologique,
oui.
Je pense au Bélazel, au faire tabernacle, au faire, au construire, et si cela a eu une importance aussi dans la réception de la Kabbale au XVIe siècle, la Renaissance, enfin, dans le sens que l'idée de l'homo faber, l'homme qui peut faire, et donc je n'y avais jamais pensé, mais effectivement, c'est peut-être ce qui a fasciné beaucoup, et même cette idée que vous avez dit, on parle souvent de syncrétisme pour Pic, pour Ficerin et pour les néoplatoniciens italiens, si ce n'est pas aussi cette fascination de cette idée de l'inclusivité que vous avez dit, qui a pu les fasciner. Première question.
Vous savez, c'est trois questions.
Donc je me demandais s'il n'y a pas aussi un chemin vers la perfection, parce que dans l'idée des Sephiroth, je vois que on parle pas
de... Je n'ai pas un problème. Just in English.
Okay.
So, you have more than one question. For syncretism. Syncretism is indeed a very strong late 15th century Italian story. Ficino, Enrico, and others, including Lore, Gila, Valeri, many others, entered an eclectic mode. Because the new forms of knowledge was revealed to the last third of the 15th century. But this syncretism was not recognized as syncretism. It was recognized as pre-scatologia, which means a certain form of ancient theology was one, but it was misunderstood, and we are now putting that together. Historically speaking, it's true, that's syncretism. Greek philosophy and Hellenistic philosophies and magic and astral magic, whatever, entered Florence and then became a certain form of Pico and Ficino. That's not what happened in today. What happened today is we have a one to one synthesis. Take today's and Aristotle. I'm on it. Take today's and Platonic philosophy in Babylon. You have Judaism, Hermeticism, certain things, which is not the eclectic part. What happened that, for a variety of reasons I cannot enter here, Italy was invaded from 1463 by a variety of new forms of knowledge in Italy. Whatever came from the Byzantine Empire and what came from Spain, the Jews, and that was, how to put it, a perplexing moment. So the Italians, following some fathers of the church, created the idea, the pre-scatologia. There was one Christian theology before the Christians, and all those guys and all the differences, in fact, are misunderstandings. So that is syncretism from our point of view. Not for their point of view. From their point of view, Ficino and Pico, especially Pico, but also Ficino, when he wrote the Deptina Christiana, syncretist, not me. I'm a Catholic thinker. What he wrote in other places is another story. That's the truth. But they didn't speak about syncretism. That we are speaking about syncretism. Jews, including Jewish philosophers, who knew other forms of philosophy, who were not syncretistic because they didn't adopt at the same time a variety of philosophies, like Ficino, for example, or like Pico. So that's another cultural moment. They didn't have access, in one generation to at least 10 different systems, from Pythagoreanism, Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, and Kabbalah, and astral magic, and whatever, in one generation everything is available, and people attempt to make sense, and then they create, from our point of view, syncretistic system. From their point of view, they're creating the ancient Christianity before Jesus.
The Jews were creating simple things. Simple. Monotheists, one form with another. So that's why we don't have basically a Jewish Renaissance in the sense of Pico or Fatima. So I can give you a long answer if you like, but that's the short one. The Christian Renaissance figures, they were building on what can be called multilinear forms of knowledge. Pythagoras received one revelation, Hermes another revelation, Plato another revelation, and the Jews received also a revelation, and all of them in one way or another intuited something. None of them intuited the truth. Only the Christians had the truth. That is one strategy, the cultural strategy, which the Jews never adopted, including the Jews in Florence who knew Ficino and Pico. Their assumption is there's one truth and all the others took it from us. So it's a totally different strategy, which if you like I can give you a lecture, but it's not the time. And so that's another set of mind, which is very, very Italian, in fact very Florentine, not Italian, Florentine, from 1463, not before. And then it created the syncretism. And in Europe it became more and more syncretistic in the 16th century. So your guy is even more syncretist because he knew more. But in Jewish philosophy, the syncretism is always simpler. Without giving the expression to so many people, so that's the simple of the story. So we had another question which I thought was, you know.
Je me demandais s'il n'y a pas un itinéraire dans la
question. Ah, oui.
Je pense au Sefirot.
I would like not to address now the issue of Sefirot because it's not what you will understand. There was a way of perfection in this, and that is the commandment, the activity. And the activity was conceived to be, to a very great extent, redemptive. But it was not simply an individual perfection. What is quintessential in your question is that for someone like Pico, it was the individual perfection that is redemptive. That's my fulfillment. That's not exactly what we find in Kabbalah. Pico took the idea of perfection without the ideas of the commandments. He didn't create a community. Never, even not in Mirandola, nowhere. He was a problematic figure who understood that he's problematic, and that's why he converted at the end of his life to Socrates. But he was problematic, and he didn't attempt to create a communal philosophy. He created an individual vision in which his perfection, or one's perfection, that was never. All the others simply don't exist. So that's a different form of perfection. It's perfection based on action. But who knows what action? It's contemplation, which is Greek form of action. So I shall speak about contemplation later. Philosophy is contemplation. Pico bought this idea of contemplation, and he called it action. And he believes that by this contemplation he is going to convert into an angel, maybe into a God. So, none other than Pico decided it was a mistake. And he recognized this mistake by converting to Girolamo Savonarola truth and by telling people to burn his books. So, that's, he understood that individual perfection didn't work. Even for Pico da Milano. I don't know for whom it works, but for sure not for Pico da Milano. It's true? Okay. So I hope that it's true, that it's legend that he converted. I don't know, I'm repeating what is written.
No, je pensais à un ouvrage de Lefebvre Bottery, oui. Où il y a un voix céleste.
That's found also in Pico da Milano. a letter that he was sent from below on high, that's found in Pramirandola, listening to discussions in Heta Heptaplus, and that's in Tatarani, that's found in two places in Pico also, but that is individual project. This letter of the saint is found in Pico, and it has also Jewish sources, but on the top of the letter, that's contemplation, contemplation. So that is not deed, but a mental thing. So that's another issue which I cannot enter into details.
So we begin again at 2:30.
For today's, at least after 2 hours, I hope that I convince you that today is something totally different. Nevertheless, now I'm going to show you that what we know is also correct, but it's simply different. And my issue is how to describe to you and explain to you what happened to the archaic, performative, anthropomorphic, anthropopathic concept today. Why we don't believe it so. So there was basically a revolution of Philo in the 60s. Philo was the first reformer who attempted to tell another story about this. He did it. He had a success in the Christian world. He didn't have a success in the Jewish world, so the Jewish world didn't change because of Philo. It was totally rejected. However, maybe in a way, Philo long range succeeded. Maybe, which means that by creating the basis of Christian theology, there's no doubt that he contributed greatly to Christian theology. He created a certain form of thinking in which commentary or interpretation and speculation were brought together. That is not found in classical today's. In classical today, you have commentaries. In the philosophy, you don't have speculative commentaries. That is found in Philo. That entered afterwards Christianity in a very powerful way, especially from Origen. He's quoting Philo, not always quoting, not always naming Philo, but quoting a lot. So, the way in which Christian theology developed as a certain form of philosophical theology and theological commentary created a challenge for the other forms of Judaism. But this challenge was not strong enough in order to compel Jewish theologians to react to it. Not only not to adopt, but even not to react. And then we have another development, which is the emergence of Muslim theology in the 7th, 8th century. And also Jews, then Jews decided not to react. But what happened later, in late 9th century, early 10th century, we have a change in some Jewish elite in the Middle East, Baghdad, Cairo, in Egypt, southern Italy, Sicily, northern Africa, a little bit in southern France. The Jews started one to study books of Islam, wrote philosophical books, but also write philosophical commentaries. So this is the beginning of what is called today the medieval Jewish philosophy. Is that philosophy? It's a big question, depends on what do you describe as philosophy. According to my personal view, there's only one single book of Jewish philosophy written in the Middle Ages. That is a book lost in a Assyrian language. That's the book of a great singer named Salomon Imbapirol, or Avicebrol, in Latin, who wrote a purely philosophical, book named The Fountain of Life, Fons Vitae, which disappeared in Arabic, was preserved in Latin. And that's, for me, symbolic. The fact that the book disappeared in its original is symbolic. The Jewish community was not interested in it. Preserved by Christian theologians. Translated and quoted it a lot. So Salomon Imbapirol, or Avicebrol, wrote a real first and maybe the last Jewish medieval philosophical book, which is purely philosophical, which means it doesn't quote the Bible at most at all, but it is a neo-Platonic way of thinking, very systematic, very abstract. Not a commentary. This, for me, is in fact the beginning, but maybe the end also of Jewish philosophy in the ages. What do we have in addition to it? We have theology, theological commentaries, apologetics. And all of them started at the beginning of the 10th century, basically in areas in which Greek culture, as promoted by Arabs, was powerful, not so much by Christians. All those places, Baghdad, for example, was a big center, Basra, Egypt, Northern Africa. There, the Arab philosophy translated basically from Syriac, translated from Greek, made a big impact on some Arab thinkers. And the Jews who were part of this entourage, to put it so, started to react. But the reaction was basically positive. I mean, people who didn't like it didn't write anything, that's all. But those who reacted do it basically in a positive way. And that was connected, in my opinion, to what I told you earlier, to the perplexion. Here we have one very nice edifice, transparent, logical, order, understand. On the other side, you have this chaos of Talmudic text, associative, performative. You know, what can you tell to your colleague, the theologians, about who you speak about God, you don't know by yourself. So here, there was a certain form of breaking. I call it breaking of the nerves, but that's not a nice term, because they didn't become crazy. They became different. It was sure breaking. But from a rabbinic point of view, it was a breaking of the nerves, as I shall explain for you. Meaning, it is sure that at a certain moment, theology entered a very small elite, but a very powerful elite, which started now to write, basically not in Hebrew, and that's also very important. Basically, but a little bit here and there. I don't know about the Hebrew, Sabbath, I don't know, in southern Italy. But most of them wrote in Arabic, which reflects this form of opening toward Arab. The second issue, which is also very, very important, very difficult to write philosophical books in the Hebrew they knew. They didn't have terms. It's not a matter of goodwill, it's a matter you don't know how to say. So it was easier to write in Arabic, which was already an acculturated language, in which you have already the Greek terminology translated, and to write in Hebrew when you simply don't have the terms. So that's why the first books, including Imbapirol's book, written in Arabic, and Sadia's books, and Maimonides' books, almost all the important books, Donolor is an exception, Sabbatai Donolor in southern Italy, were written in Arabic, written for a public of intellectuals, and to a certain extent also for non-Jews, in which we have the first effort to explain Judaism in Greek terms, That's obviously Greek, because that's, you know, there's no doubt that it doesn't have to be demonstrated, because we see exactly how the Arabic philosophy enters this. That's, they are quoting, and we know that the sources are basically Arabic, which are not the source, but the intermediary between the Greek and Hellenistic philosophy and the Middle Ages. So, that represented, in fact, breakthrough in Jewish thought, which was until then different. So, what is the meaning? Let me attempt to summarize the meaning. The difference, and then I'll share it in detail. The first important thing is that the rabbinic, or the biblical rabbinic force of today, which is very comprehensive, was reduced. What do you mean comprehensive? There are many forms of activities which are important. The commandments from the morning to the evening, there's not one mode of action which is important. A religion based on sounds, reading the Torah, studying the Talmud, are not mental. We assume today that mental activity, that's a mistake. People studying is shouting. Go to any shiva today, you see there's no study there. People are arguing, shouting. Meaning it's all the time some form of loud entourage around you. You don't sit there and contemplate or study or read mentally. This form is simply not Jewish until now. So to read the Torah doesn't mean that you're reading the text mentally. That is no value. To read the Torah is to pronounce loudly the Torah. To pray is not mental prayer. It is vocal prayer. So performance is not only to do something, but also to articulate loudly. So this form of Judaism is reduced to one basic activity, which is mental. Meaning, the good Jew is a philosopher. That's what basically the Jewish philosophy introduced, taken from Muslim philosophy, taken from Greek philosophy. Meaning, a reduction to the complexity of the person, living by doing and living in a community, to an individual which is concerned with his intellectual development. That's what matters. This reduction is dramatic, but nevertheless never recognized as such. None of the philosophers says, look, I am a reformer. I have now the real vision of Judaism. All the others are mistaken. They were part of communities, they couldn't do it. Maybe they didn't want to do it. Maybe they were not aware that they are doing it. That's not a simple question. Nevertheless, what's important, they didn't explicitly say something. They claim that Judaism has two dimensions. One is the old one. And the other is the hidden one, or the esoteric one, which is the philosophical one. So then the strategy was to create two levels of interpretation, or two levels of existence, in which the plain sense, the external sense, is common. And that's good, plus minus. But for the individual, the esoteric, intellectual dimension is much more important. And that is, in fact, philosophy. However, it's not a philosophy which is detached from the Bible, but given the fact that they wrote to a community, they attempted to impose their philosophy within the Bible, to say that it's found in the Bible. So that is not a simple enterprise. So I should give you examples how difficult it is, but that is the strategy. Move away from reduction, from performance and vocalization, and create a mental religion which is philosophical. again, none of them dare to say, look, what all the other Jews are doing is illegal. But that was objective, without explicating it. So I shall try to give you examples to understand it in a more precise way by returning to the term tzele or image. That is the crucial issue. Jews read for sure the first page of the Bible. If you cannot demonstrate that tzele or image is mind, God's mind and our mind, you are lost. Even what is important in the first chapter of the Bible, that God is a form or a body, and we are quintessentially a body, we are lost. So philosophy is not important. So the great battle had to do with already with the first chapter of the Bible, especially with the idea of itself, but not only. For example, how can you imagine a philosophical God speaking? It's anthropomorphic. What God is speaking? What type of God is it? So here we have, in fact, the encounter, the real encounter, in the commentary. You can write, like in Gabirol, a nice book of philosophy without saying anything about the Bible. It's always nice. Okay, there's no problem. But that was the exception. The rule was different. The rule was that you attempt to convince people that that is the real Jesus. So that you must do it by commentaries. So, for example, the first chapter in Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed deals with the image of God in Genesis 1:26. He understood, if he doesn't prove it, he's lost. So the first chapter is an incredible exercise by a genius like Maimonides to convince us that the term tzele in Hebrew means mind. You don't have to be a great specialist. You see the great efforts he's doing, you see the simplicity. And you know, all these examples don't follow what he said. Simply that, is there a huge distortion? How can you see the distortion? Just open any Hebrew dictionary today. After 700 years of Maimonides, with all his influence, none of the Jewish linguists will speak about tzele as mind. No one. Because they are looking into the Bible and not into the philosophy of Maimonides. So there's no one single linguist which will adopt Maimonides' reading. Which for me is that the final proof that Maimonides, not only he's wrong, he attempted to convince others that this linguistic impossibility is hiding the higher sense, and this higher sense doesn't exist in any dictionary today, despite the great respect for Maimonides. So I have a way to describe Maimonides such. He attempted actually to explain to us the perplexion of someone reading the Bible and seeing some form of archaic Judaism, you have to call it primitive Judaism, anthropomorphic Judaism, to offer a much more sublime idea of Judaism by starting with this tzele is, according to him, the image which is the mind of God, which is Aristotle, purely Aristotle. If you read Aristotle's book of metaphysics, Lambda, you can see that's the source, he's given the source. So he attempted to rescue Jews from perplexion. They are reading Aristotle in Arabic, seeing a very sublime form of deity. And now they are reading the Bible, and they are not compatible, because it's not in modern terms, not compatible. So he attempted to impose the Greek on the English. So my way, so what happens? You can convince some people that you are right, But what happened to all the other people that you don't know this? So they became perplexed. So my way to describe the guide is a guide of a perplex which created more perplexions than guidance. So this is not my belated vision, but that is what happened immediately in Israel. What happened with the emergence of Jewish philosophy, but especially Maimonides, but not only Maimonides. It started before Zinga Birol, which book was eliminated by fire. But with Maimonides it was much, much worse. Meaning the biggest ever controversy in Judaism took place. So that's for me the sign that's a revolution. It's not what I am telling you now, nice stories of Greeks and meaning the reaction of the vast majority of the Jewish intellectuals. I don't speak about popular Judaism who couldn't read Maimonides, never heard about Maimonides. I speak about the intellectuals, meaning rabbis. Didn't buy it at all. And they actually created a storm in the East. And then also in Europe. In which Maimonides' book was banned. Banned. Which is something very, very, very rare in Judaism. Maybe even burned. Not by Jews, but by the Inquisition, but maybe by the intervention of some Jews, as claimed by a scholar in Verona. That's the only source I have, was written in Verona by a Maimonidean named Hillel of Verona, who claims that when he was in Spain, he had seen this burning. So maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, we don't know for sure. But that's the only source we have. It was burned by the Inquisition. Which means that confrontation was unparalleled before or later ever in Judaism. That genius of the statue of Maimonides. Let's speak about, you know, some marginal figures. Speak about maybe the most important figure in Judaism in his lifetime, who wrote incredible legalistic books, incredible. Now, to bend such a figure, it means that he touched a nerve, which was extremely important. Because otherwise, Jews wouldn't say, look, if you have your theology, it's not a problem, we don't care about you. But someone of the stature of Maimonides, in a moment I'll speak more about it, created immediately a very, very sharp reaction, the sharper reaction we could imagine. We couldn't actually imagine in the days before such a reaction. But since it took place, it took place. So that has to do with the reduction. I mean, the commandments are for sure important. But it's such a logical story. In a moment, I'll give you examples. For sure, we need some form of common behavior. But what is higher than it is, that's the point of relation. This issue means also that God is a mind. If he's a mind, how does he hear what we are praying? Why does he care about what we are doing? So if this is the theology, basic parts of Judaism are, if not non-important, they are auxiliary. They are a step not to advance beyond the step. I assume that was Maimonides' view. Most Judaism in its rabbinic form is totally futile. But it is a step in the history of religion. And now I shall give you examples. So here we have, in fact, the first time with a very sharp, exclusive theology. Meaning, if God is a mind, and that is the ultimate truth, so someone who doesn't accept something like that is idolatrous, which means that all the people who believe in it, which is the vast majority of the Jews, which means the Bible, which means the rabbis, were idolaters. So that's an implication which the rabbis would have been given the first. But it was enough to understand and discover that what Maimonides is doing, he is actually undermining, subverting all their traditions. And what was worse, that Maimonides, in some places, made it explicit. I mean, not explicit by telling you very sharply everything, but in some cases, he was not cautious enough. Saying that whoever who doesn't believe that God is incorporeal, he's an heretic, said he. So, there are some people who don't care to be insulted in such a way, but they cannot how to bear that their father and grandfather will be described as heretics. That was too much. And we have immediate reactions in my mother's lifetime. Then how do you speak about our grandfathers? They were heretics. And that started this very sharp controversy about who is my mother? Is he the root true Judaism, or is he the false Judaism? Now this controversy, which started in his lifetime, around 2000, never finished up to today. It's not a controversy which would stop ever. It had moments of up and down. But this controversy is taking place even today in whatever big Jewish community. But what I'm concerned now is the first phase, meaning 2000-2030. That's the issue which interests me more. It was sharp controversy. A lot of communities participated in the Orient, in the Middle East, and in Europe. And Judaism was divided on this issue. Divided because at stake was not a certain theology alone, it was a philosophy of action. Is contemplation more important, or is performance more? Is God a body or is a mind? Is our action meaningful or without a sense? So that imposition of the exclusive theology, which meaning God cannot be two, because everything spiritual is by definition one. So this vision, which is basically Aristotelian, claims that there is a final theological truth, and anything else, any deviation, is idolatry. That is the exclusive part of theology, which is very powerful because there is a sense of ultimate truth. If you have the ultimate truth, everything is idolatry. Which means someone brings with you in the same synagogue, the same text, but having another idea of God, he is an heretic, doesn't matter if he's a good Jew or not. That simply doesn't matter. And now I shall give you some more detailed examples about how Maimonides worked this vision. In his most important book from the theological point of view, The Guide of Perplexed, he had some theory of the ritual. Now, until now, we have theory. We have rituals without theory. Here, we have no theory, almost no ritual. Now, so he started with a simple example. The simple example is sacrifices. Ancient Judaism was basically a matter of sacrifices. That's the biblical, the center of Judaism. The performance par excellence is the sacrifice. You don't have sacrifices. Sacrifices today, so one explanation would be, okay, that's an inferior form of religion. Because we don't have the temple, so we cannot sacrifice. So the Judaism is impossible today because of external, accidental reasons. So that would any rabbi tell you that the best of the world will have a temple, have sacrifices, and that is part and parcel of the messianic aspirations. And one of this came with another explanation. He said, sacrifices was a compromise. antiquity, everyone was sacrificing. So what did they do? They minimalized it. They brought all the sacrifices to one place, the temple. Not to reduce it. Not to have sacrifices on every hill. Every temple. So he said that is a compromise. And since today, in the Middle Ages, we are more advanced, we are beyond it. Meaning, Judaism, as he put it, is superior to the biblical Judaism. Not because of an accident, because a divine strategy. God understood that you cannot educate the people by one revelation. So he created some form of compromise. With the assumption that by evolution, religion is going to be purified and become a mental religion. That's why sacrifice doesn't exist today, and that's for good. It doesn't say for good, but it's with implication. Okay, Jews soon react to something like that, because, okay, everyone knows that there are no sacrifices. And Maimonides was not against sacrifices in principle from the legalistic point of view, but he put it in such a way which is a big insult to an elite which is very legalistic, to tell them that, you know, you deal all the time with compromises. It's not a real intention of God, it's not the will of God, it's a compromise. God compromised the human nature. That is Jesus. However, he moved beyond it, and then when the rabbi said that we don't have sacrifices, but we have instead prayer, he said, oh, prayer for sure, articulated prayer. Everyone is praying, so it's another compromise. God cannot hear our prayer. So it's a compromise because, you know, that's the way people are praying. But hear prayer is mental. That becomes a little bit more problematic. That to tell you that that's the major form of Jewish commandment. Be a prayer or study of the Torah. So that is another compromise which is going to disappear. It's only a matter of time. So Maimonides came with basically a Hegelian theory, long before Hegel, telling you religion is moving from the concrete to the spiritual. And on the way are phases of development. And what was earlier is obsolete. What is good is later. So such a vision marginalizes, attenuates, obliterates. Everyone can choose his words, not so clear. The classical forms of Judaism as practiced in Maimonides' lifetime. So it's not a matter of commentary on Genesis 1:26. What Maimonides attempted was a whole reform of Judaism, from theology up to practice, up to anthropology. Because what is a real Jew? Someone who is contemplating God. That was a big God, that matter what he's doing. So such a huge reform, despite the fact it was done, how to put it, in a cautious way, but he couldn't be so cautious because even he couldn't, how to put it, avoid some moments of more explicit discussions. And it became clear for many people that it cannot work. So here we have the introduction of the exclusive theology, which means openly. An heretical vision of 99% of all the Jews from the beginning up to Maimonides. Means those who didn't know Maimonides were lost. Heretics. All the great rabbis, according to Maimonides, if they subscribe to the Sanhedrin, they were heretics. So he didn't say it in such a way, but it was the implication. So how he did it actually later, how did he find a way to introduce it? But what was important is that this reform
was conceived in such a way by his contemporaries. It's not my reading now. It is the reading of the vast majority of the Jews, not for example, but the vast majority of the Jews who didn't buy this exclusive theology. But I use the term theology in a large sense, still involves the rituals articulated. So that's why the controversy was so ferocious. It was not about a commentary, it was not about a private theology. Because Maimonides decided to declare formally, legalistically, most of the Jewish elite is heretic. So the others couldn't but react. They had to react. They couldn't be silent. Because what's the about the major figure making a major claim about what is good and what is bad in Jesus? So this exclusive vision created immediately very sharp reactions, which divided not only a matter of some letters exchanged by some people, we're speaking about far away from Egypt. Think about communities in Provence, in Germany, in Spain, divided, communicating with each other. Not only Maimonides, but also the others. Maimonides had his supporters in Maimonides' discussions. So, here we can see the revolution, because it was recognized on the spot. Not by me, but by so many who have a whole literature about it. Not everyone was so privileged to be in my position to look back and to see all the history of Greek philosophy and translation and implications. For sure, some of them were poor rabbis who knew what they knew, but they didn't have the history of philosophy. They couldn't say, in Maimonides, you took Aristotle, put it on our side. So, since they reacted from time to time in a more oblique way, but believe me, very powerful. So, why did Maimonides succeed? And that is the real question. Why he attempted, it's no problem. He was a big intellectual, had good control of Arab language and Arabic philosophy. He was seduced by Aristotelians. So this was a private story of Maimonides, which I can easily understand. The real problem is, how did he succeed? Okay, so you are a genius, and you create for yourself a system, and you are prone to be rejected by all the Jews, no exception. So here the situation is a bit more complex, and that I must make a parenthesis to tell you why did he succeed to a certain extent. So Maimonides was born in Andalusia, which was an extraordinarily rich, intellectually rich place in his lifetime. He was not the only Jewish thinker who bought Arabic philosophy. That was the entire Jewish elite. In a certain small place, Andalusia. Cordoba, basically Cordoba, and earlier Malaga, Sevilla, but basically for our purposes, Cordoba. That was the Jewish Andalusian elite, not Spanish, because Spain was then divided into Christian and Muslim, and the word Muslim state. So Maimonides was not alone. Why did he leave Andalusia and left to Northern Africa and to Egypt? Because some Muslim fundamentalists from Northern Africa invaded Andalusia and compelled, in fact, all the Jewish elites and the Muslim elites either to be silent or to leave. They also didn't like philosophy. So Maimonides escaped by the south. Other parts of the Jewish Andalusian elite escaped by the north, and they arrived to Provence, Montpellier, Foscari. When Maimonides wrote his book,
it arrived to the Andalusian, to the former Andalusian, living now in Provence. Living in Provence, you know Arabic. So what did they do? They translated not only Maimonides, also other philosophical books, including Arabic philosophical books, but Maimonides was important. Translation, which was part of what I call the Andalusian International. Meaning people coming from the same place, but dispersed because of historical accidents, are attempting to regroup together. And they attempted, the Andalusian elite, in Provence, to promote Maimonides, because it was part and part of their culture. So they translated. The translation only aggravated the situation. Because as long as it was an Arabic, so it was an Oriental story. But in the moment it translated in Hebrew, it becomes an international Jewish story. So, to a certain extent, the controversy has to do with translation, but not only with translation. But the Andalusian elite took the side of Maimonides. So Maimonides was not standing alone in Egypt and, you know, conquering the smaller elites, because there was a larger cultural basis, the Andalusian one, which were living in different places, including Verona. His village of Verona is a Maimonidean coming from Spain. I don't know if he was Andalusian by origin or not, but that is part of the Maimonidean camp. Coming from Provence to Spain and keeping this former tradition, which was considered at the moment very plausible, because look what happened. The Muslims are saying the same. The Christians, you know, were speaking about one generation before Thomas d'Aquinas, another Aristotelian. Meaning, at a certain moment, Europe started to speak Aristotelian language. So, this more Andalusian elite had the feeling that they are en vogue, meaning consonant with what's going on in the big world. It's not so small. So, Maimonides, despite the fact that he was totally exceptional in Judaism, had a certain support from a cultural structure building Andalusia, and encouraged later on in Italy by translation made here from Arabic sources, and also for sure in Spain, which brought Aristotle to the attention of the European world. And then people say, Maimonides for sure, you know, that's real in today's. We are not worse than all the others. In fact, you know, Thomas Aquinas is quoting Maimonides. And other Franciscan thinkers are quoting even Gabriel openly. So what's great about it? So here we have, in fact, a cultural development in which Maimonides fitted very nicely for a small elite. And this small elite supported Maimonides against very ferocious attacks coming from older classical rabbinic elite. So, that is the reason why Maimonides survived. A long human survived. That's what, despite that he was a genius, he was recognized by a genius as a genius by his opponents. He wouldn't survive without the support of a small but very powerful elite with a very high culture, coming from Andalus, with Arabic culture, with knowing Arabic, much more advanced than Christian elites or classical Jewish elites. This elite was very powerful. They could translate, which is in a moment very, very important, into Hebrew. And they created, in fact, the basis of a certain acceptance of Maimonides. I'm saying a certain acceptance of Maimonides, not acceptance. Because the vast part of European Jewry didn't accept. There were individuals who accepted, but that's a small part. So, a clear issue is translation. However, this translation is a miracle. Because how do you translate Greek philosophy into Hebrew on modern terms. So here the Andalusians, especially two major families, Ibn Tibbon, Tibbonites, and the Kimchi family, two families who came from Andalusia to Provence, they made the impossible and created a new Hebrew language. And the philosophical Hebrew language that we know by reading what they wrote, we see terms which didn't exist, calques, actually translations from Arabic, which are translations from Greek, and Genesis, exactly, the tables, the Hebrew, Arabic, and the Greek source. But at the time, also Syriac. So we see how it was translated, or mistranslated. So here the clue is that this small elite was able not just to adopt a vision, but also to translate into Hebrew, create a language which is theological and is totally new. Otherwise, Maimonides wouldn't exist. Maimonides is in Arabic, and he wrote his Guide of the Prophets in Arabic. There are scarcely 4 or 5 manuscripts of the book in Arabic. That means nothing. The Hebrew translations, that's another story. There are hundreds of manuscripts. So that shows that, in fact, without translation, which means accommodation of his thought to Hebrew terms for a European, basically European Jewry, he wouldn't be what he was. So let's have an hour. So again, I would like to have 3 or 4 minutes of clarification. If you don't have, it's no problem. But if you have questions, which are small questions, big questions, it's difficult.
Well, I have a lot, but
I
just ask the most simple one. So Maimonides, he wrote in Arabic.
He wrote in Hebrew and Arabic.
He translated.
No. Maimonides wrote in 2 languages. He wrote in Hebrew, wrote in Arabic. In Arabic, he wrote the philosophical book, the Guide of the Prophets. And he wrote also some medical works. But his legalistic works on the Talmud, his commentary on the Mishnah, he wrote, commentary on the Mishnah, he wrote in Arabic. But he wrote in Hebrew a big codex named Mishneh Torah, or the second Torah, if you like, very interesting, the title. It's an audacious title. No one dared ever to write a book which is called in plain Hebrew, Mishneh Torah, which is the second Torah. That is a reformer. That he wrote in Hebrew.
Yes, why did he write some books in Arabic and
because he wrote to two different audiences. One audience in Arabic was the philosophical. In the Hebrew, it was more general Jewish and much less philosophical. Philosophical, but much less. And people argued also about books in Hebrew. Because Maimonides, what he attempted to do in Hebrew when he wrote this second Torah, the meaning of his Mishneh Torah, was to say, look, we have all this Talmudic literature with all the debates and all the decisions of rabbis, and that's impossible to understand. I'm going to summarize everything and finalize. I'm writing you now a codex which turns, in fact, the Talmud and the discussions after Talmud superfluous. So the rabbis reacted to it also, telling me, what does it mean? We like the debates. We don't want to make this decision. The decision we can do by ourselves. We like to see the life of debate. Maimonides didn't like this debate. He wanted to summarize and give the ultimate verdict. So Rabbi said, that's, you know, it's not a Jewish way of arguing. To tell you the, you know, the bottom line, what do you mean the bottom line? Who are you to tell us the bottom line? We like the Talmud in the mode the Talmud was written, by arguing. We like to learn how to argue, not only in the final decision. So that was also conceived negative. So the fact that he was born with the name Moses gave him the idea that it's a good idea to have a new Moses. And that's why indeed he was called in such a way by his followers. From Moses to Moses, there was no Moses. You know, that's a strong statement made on him, and I believe he believed it. That he is the second Moses, who is going to write the second Torah. And that is the ultimate Torah. The earlier Torah was good for education for a while, but now we have something much more refined. And that's me. I'm on this. Who is doing it? People understood it immediately. I mean, that's very hard to. No, his followers facilitated the whole story by telling there was no one after Moses like him, is to say, all the other rabbis, you know, the great Talmudic rabbis were something, but not Talmudists. That is a big insult for a whole tradition. To say that in the entire Talmudic period, there was no one like Maimonides. Agathiba, for example. That's a big insult. To say you don't need all this. That's good for maybe a small elite, but I am writing you and back the new Torah. That created the turmoil. So, the Arabic part was intended for sure for a small elite. And it is very difficult in a moment to speak more about how did he write it. Another spacious style, unexisting in any other place in the world. But I answered your question about language. You have another question? Okay, fine. No other question. Now, we're speaking about the Guide of the Perplexed, a book that is called Philosophy. When you open and you read it, you are really perplexed. First, not because you don't understand, but because Maimonides is saying at the very beginning of the book, there are seven types of contradictions in the book. And those contradictions, according to one of his strategies, is to hide the real idea Maimonides had. That created a quandary that even today scholars don't know what Maimonides thinks. But he's bringing two different opposing ideas. For example, was the world created or it was continuous creation? There's no way to decide, because there's a contradiction, but you don't know on what corner of the contradiction he's deciding. So that is, in addition to all the problems created by the philosophical exclusive mode, he wrote in a style which is at the same time a commentary, despite the fact it's not a commentary, because he doesn't write chapter after chapter of the Bible, but it's a commentary for many different people. It's also a philosophical world, despite the fact there's no system there, visible. And it is an enigmatic book, because he's never telling you the real truth. Telling you from the very beginning that he's contradicting himself consciously. Not telling us, you know, as I put it at the beginning, everyone is contradicting himself. That's for sure, he said, that's for sure. But in addition, he said, I contradict myself by purpose, which means that you never know. We can guess, and that's a lot of scholarship about what was his real idea, but no one can prove what was his real idea, because he was so clever. There's no way to finally prove what was his. That's why that's an enigmatic book, written by a genius who understood that by writing in a plain sense, he's going to be not only excommunicated, his book is not going to survive at all. So he understood that his strategy is necessary for survival of the book. So he used the strategy of fragmentation, for example. Writing about the same topic in five or six different chapters. And this topic is dealt differently in each chapter. So you can compare and compare and compare, but you don't know actually what's the basis and what is the contradiction. And that's not one topic or two topics, but that is, and he's putting properly. You must read me comparatively, to compare what I wrote here to what I wrote there, what I wrote. He could just say what he's thinking, but that's not found there. And when he's saying, like in the idea of a ceremony, or he is doing something which is shocking from the linguistic point of view, so simply you don't know what to think. Means he wrote it for, as he put it, I write the book for one of 10 of 100,000. That's the way he put it in the introduction. Meaning, he wrote the book which is still today, after centuries of scholarship, a great enigma. That's why we have many commentaries, some 50 commentaries on this book, and believe me, there are not two commentaries telling the same story. Everyone has another idea, and all of them are right and wrong at the same time. And that became a whole industry to understand what was really Maimonides. So,
okay,